This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back to Reality Check Radio here with Marie. Joining me now, all the way from Washington, D.C., Rolf Scholhammer, head of the Center for Applied History at the MCC in Budapest, but currently in Washington. And Rolf, I'm so excited to have you on the show. I'm a huge fan. I've watched you on GB News, and I've been bugging my producer for months that I needed to talk to you. So here you are. Welcome along.
So well, they should have They should have reached out earlier. I'm very honored. I'm highly appreciative of being on, and I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
No, I'm really looking forward to it too. And you cover so much ground, and the two big places that you cover are the whole dynamics of politics internationally and also in response to the COVID response. So I'm going to start sort of with international politics, because we've had a really fascinating year. We're at the end of 2024 now. About a third of the world's population has voted. So looking back across the lens of 2024, have things fallen how you thought they would fall on the electoral front internationally?
Let's maybe not as significantly as they did. I think if we look at what's the most remarkable development that we can currently observe, particularly in the West, is that people no longer think that the status quo is sustainable. So when we, and I'm not saying that these distinctions are entirely meaningless, you know, some people say that, oh, left and right, these paradigms no longer work. No, there are left-wing parties and there are right-wing parties. I think that's still an important distinction. But what is at the core of their electoral success, I think, is that people are looking for non-status quo parties. And I would argue that as a framework to analyze what happened, if you look at Donald Trump, right, I think what made Donald Trump attractive is he's a non-status quo guy. What makes Nigel Farage interesting in the UK is at least he appears to be a non-status quo guy. Whether he will deliver, we'll see. Right? I think I have my issues with him, but at least that's his, that's the way he tries to color himself. Marine Le Pen in France, non-status quo girl in this case. Giorgia Meloni in Italy, Viktor Orban in Hungary. So we can go the entire roster of these new politicians. And I think what unifies them, what they have in common, is not so much the policies. There are quite significant differences if you take, for example, Le Pen and Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. Wilders is economically almost libertarian, whereas Le Pen is very much in the French tradition of government and state intervention. But they both share this idea that on matters of migration, on energy policy, on foreign policy, on the direction of the European Union, on the general condition of the West as a civilization, that the status quo of the last couple of decades is no longer sustainable. That they have in common. And I think that people sense that. I think that there is a general feeling of either we attempt a renewal, a renaissance, if you want, or to use Donald Trump's term, to make insert your favorite country there great again, or we accept decline. And I'm very heartened by the fact to see that more and more Europeans, but also Americans, I think the same is true in Australia and New Zealand, say, you know what? We don't think our time has come. We don't think that the West is supposed to go into the long night. And why not try to revive it? Why not try to renew it and vote into office politicians, parties, movements that actually say we want to do something different? We don't just want to manage decline. We actually want to reverse it. And I think that's a very encouraging sign.
Yeah, well, in the early stages, you mentioned Giorgia Meloni. Meloni and Milei in Argentina is the other one that I've been following. Both of them,
the
media signaled that this would be almost the end of the earth. This was the worst thing that could have happened. They've both been there long enough now that, to use a cricketing term, they've got some pretty good runs on the board and things are looking good. Meloni is more moderate than the media gave her credit for and stabilising. And Milei, he has quite a different style, but he's seeing results. The public is seeing this, but still the media clings on as if it's nothing to see here. Why do you think that they're clinging on so tightly to this idea that change is a bad thing?
Well, because the media is, or the mainstream media, as we would say, because you are also a media creator, if you want, as am I. But we are what was generally called the alternative media, kind of the new media. But the mainstream media, the legacy media, because they're invested in the status quo. And for good reason. I mean, they have been promoting all the politicians that are, I would say, the most or the strongest examples of what makes the status quo, right? This idea, as Angela Merkel said 20 years ago, there is no alternative, right? There's a certain way of doing politics. There's a certain way of looking at certain things, at the matter of migration, at economic policy, at, you know, gender issues, all things. There's one way to look at it, and usually that was the way in which the opinion pages of the New York Times described it. And that was the middle of the road, kind of moderate way to do things. But if you take a look, for example, at the opinion page of the New York Times, for most quote-unquote normal people, those are radical positions. Mm. I just pick a random issue here, the gender issue, because it's something I'm very invested in, but I think it highlights it quite nicely. Most people, if you talk to them among four eyes, will say there are just two genders. Right? Nobody really buys into the 77 genders kind of thing. But, you know, if all the intellectuals or the quote-unquote intellectuals or the New York Times and, you know, the London Times, if they all say it's 77 genders or 78 or whatever, 129 or whatever the last count was, you feel almost kind of pushed into saying it as well, even though you don't believe it. And I think this kind of lie was sustainable as long as things were going well economically. I think this is always, a friend of mine once used to say, you know, Ralph, don't worry about it. We are rich enough so we can afford to be stupid. But we are no longer that rich. So we are gradually can no longer afford to be stupid. So slowly but surely in all these areas where we had the luxury of believing stupid things, we no longer can do this. As I said, gender issues, green deals, migration. So all these things that, as I said, were something we could afford when we were on the top of the pile, we no longer are. So you either change or you decline, right? Or you disintegrate, or you become poorer. And as it turns out, people don't want to become poorer. People want to maintain their living standards. And by the way, I think they have a right to. And as you mentioned, Milei in Argentina. I mean, they ran this experiment in Argentina. I know you heard this very often on your show, and you talked about this as well, but it's always forgotten that up until the 1920s, Argentina was one of the richest countries in the world. Like in Switzerland, there was a saying that, I mean, you know, being rich like an Argentinian. So this was a common throwaway line, right? When you saw a wealthy person, you said, oh, this, you know, rich like an Argentinian. And then due to stupid policies, they become a very, very poor and bankrupt country. And now Milei wants to reverse this. And I wish him all the success that is possible. I think he's having that success. You can tell it because in the mainstream media, it's getting quiet. And that's the strongest indicator. Because if he would be failing, he would be all over the news. The fact that they barely talk about him tells you he's successful. And by the way, if we want to stick to Latin America for a second, Nayib Bukele in El Salvador, the same thing. Yeah. There was the argument, a law and order approach, being tough on crime doesn't work. It has to be social workers, and you have to understand. And there was one argument that the drug cartels are a very important part of the economy in El Salvador. And then you have somebody like Bukele, who's, you know, in his mid-30s, so really a very young man, he says, no, if you commit a crime, if you make crime acceptable, then our young men will not go into honest work, into honest businesses. They will become criminals, and this is going to be self-perpetuating. So what he did is he cracked down. He built prisons. He put those people into prisons, and he went with a very strict, tough law and order approach. And now El Salvador, I mean, it's amazing. From the one of the most dangerous places on the planet, it's now the safest place in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, no wonder he's treated like a rock star by his population. And this is why the media is afraid of, because after they claimed that there is no alternative to the status quo, how can they report about alternatives of the status quo when those alternatives are working? If they would all be failing, they would say, see, we told you there is no alternative. But now they would have to say, oops, there potentially is an alternative. We just didn't believe it. We were wrong. And let's be honest, who likes to admit that they were wrong?
Funny you should say that. We've just had our first tranche of a COVID inquiry released here. And I know you've been tracking these internationally. And of course, surprise, surprise, the New Zealand inquiry was a case of what I call political softly, softly, with a little bit of, you could have done things better, but overall it wasn't too bad. And I wonder, and in light of the political environment and the political environment that created and forced, and particularly in the Western canon, went along with so much groupthink, bad policy, coercion, I don't know. When will we ever get a reckoning for those bad decisions? Or is the reckoning happening at the ballot boxes by the people saying, no, we don't like how you did this, we're going with another option?
I think so. I think so. I mean, I completely agree with you. I would have liked to see a more official reckoning, and maybe also kind of politicians to admit that they have been at fault. Like, nobody would be mad at them. This is the thing, that the voters are usually very understandable. If a politician goes out and says, "We thought we did what was best. We are sorry. We were mistaken." I think most people would say, "Listen, we know you tried. I mean, this was a new situation. This could have happened." But they're doubling down. I think this, and like we see in other areas as well, that you make something wrong, and instead of saying we need to change course because what we did in the past didn't work, it's doubling down on the thing that is not working, and that's a little bit frustrating. And you see this in other areas now too. And I'm generally pragmatic on most things, also in international relations, right? You have to look at how the facts present themselves on the ground. But if you look at the war in Ukraine, talking about victory without defining what victory is a fool's errand. You cannot fight a war. Like, this is not a strategy. Like, this is like me saying, I want to get rich. And then somebody says, how are you going to do it? And I say, I don't know. Like, I have no plan. I have no path towards getting rich. That's my end goal. This is not how this works. And the same is true in the case of Ukraine. The same was true with COVID. What was the goal? What did you actually try to achieve? And this was never clearly defined. And the other thing that I found frustrating was to claim that a newly developed vaccine has no chance of having any kind of side effect, that this is completely impossible, that there's a 100% efficiency rate. I mean, let's be completely honest. What exactly in life, except death and taxes, has a 100% efficiency rate? So this was very odd. There are people out there who are allergic to penicillin. There are people out there who are allergic to sunlight. This is horrible fates, and I really pity these people, and I have a lot of compassion. But the idea that you can have a vaccination, that nobody's ever going to have any side effect, it was an absurd claim on its face, but people were forced to believe it. And I think this is a frustrating thing. And once again, you mentioned the media, the collusion of the kind of the old media and also social media, you know, YouTube, Facebook, all these other things, to kind of go along with this. This was a very terrifying thing that happened. I'm as you said, and I would also add that they could do this once. I don't think if a new pandemic would come that this would work again. The state in many ways showed that depending on who the target is, they can be very harsh, they can be very brutal. And this was, I believe, also a surprise for many people. The same governments who claimed we cannot protect the borders, right? We have no way to control who comes into our country. They were incredibly efficient at controlling who goes into a coffee shop, right? Who goes into a restaurant. So that they could do, which then created what you, I'm sure, have heard, and your viewers and listeners have heard in the UK, that there is a two-tier justice system. That if you happen to be of a specific group, the state turns a blind eye. And if you happen to be part of another group, the state looks twice as carefully as they do with anybody else. And that is unjust, because justice is not just the application of the law, it is the equal application of the law. And that is at the moment not happening. It's particularly bad in the United Kingdom, but I heard similar stories out of New Zealand. I heard similar stories out of Australia. And of course, we have similar stories in continental Europe, and we had similar stories in the United States. And this is what people are, for the moment, at the ballot booth, are revolting against. And I think it's good that they do it.
I saw an interview very recently with James Lindsay, and he, as you know, does a lot of work in the culture space. From this media perspective, that's where the space I've been working in. And I've seen both COVID and culture have been actually intertwined. So the ideologies of DEI and ESG and essentially woke ideology was at the pillars of most pandemic planning.
Yes.
In one form or another. And one of the things that he said is that he could see this dismantling. He's saying woke is over. And the two areas that will be the last to capitulate, if they capitulate at all, will be academia and the media, because one perpetrated it in academia and the other one promulgated it. So on that basis, it will be a case of people power. It will be a case of this populism that the media seems so threatened by.
I mean, I like James because For him, everything he doesn't like is fascism.
Marxism. It all comes back to Marxism. Yeah,
exactly. He's a smart guy. So I did not. I meant this as a humorous kind of interjection, not as a derogatory comment. He's a smart guy. I'm not as optimistic as him for a very simple reason, which is that usually ideologies are being defeated in two ways. One is they're being replaced by success ideology. And the second one is that for some reason they get delegitimized. And I have an example in a second I'll get to, that people just say, okay, we can no longer go along with this. We tend to forget that the argument that, you know, people did not turn away from fascism because it was intellectual. Maybe it was that too, but the main reason was not because it was intellectually defeated. It was defeated quite literally in the battlefield. And of course, the horrors of the Holocaust make it impossible, I would say, for any reasonable person to subscribe to such an ideology. I mean, fascism and National Socialism, I use them in this case interchangeable. Historians would be more critical, but for our argument here, I think it's fine to use them interchangeably. And with wokeness, well, the question is, okay, if wokeness goes away, let's stipulate this idea. What will be the success ideology? The Canadian author, and he's also very popular in your neck of the woods, Mark Stein, always makes a very good case that he says you cannot beat something with nothing. And we know what the something is, right? In some cases, it's wokeness, it's Islam, so we have all this. But we are still at the nothing stage. What would be the pillar on which you build a new Western identity? Because you see, I find it so interesting. You see, one argument is, which would be my argument, is a kind of enlightened nationalism or enlightened patriotism. But that's also still a minority view. I think this has not yet caught on to be really a replacement for, you know, the wokeness and all these other things. So I hope James is right. On the other hand, I like to fight this fight. I think it's a good battle that we're fighting here. So we would probably be out of a job, which on the one hand, the world would be a better place, but what would we complain about if it would actually happen? But I'm not yet really sure what the new thing is going to be. And you see this also, especially in Europe. So the reason why Islam is gaining strength is not because everybody is an Islamist. It is because there is nothing else. So if you come from the Middle East, if you come as a middle of the road believing Muslim, nothing special, and then you come to Europe and you realize, well, there's nothing that's offered to me that in order to become European, you're probably going to double down on your original identity. Again, not in all cases, to be very clear, but postmodern identity, if you want, is not, for some it's attractive, but for many it isn't. It's hedonistic, which can be fun, but it's not really life fulfilling. There is a sense, you know, very German way to look at the world, but that everything that has meaning has a difficulty to it, right? Everything worth having doesn't come easy. And that is just something that the postmodern world has a very hard time to offer, because there the argument is life is very short, so you might as well enjoy it as much as you can because there's nothing else, which might be factually true, but it's not very spiritually uplifting. So there is Islam as an alternative, or you see this now with Jordan Peterson. I haven't yet read his newest book, so I can't really pontificate on it, but that he writes a book titled "We Who Wrestle with God" shows him that even he, as a, I would say, staunch defender of Western civilization, doesn't really know what he wants to put that civilization on. Or take somebody else who I admire very much, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, right, who was once a member of the, I think they were called the Four Horsemen of Atheism. You know, her, Richard Dawkins, Benjamin Bennett, and a couple of other people who were like, no, God doesn't exist, and religion is, you know, the late Christopher Hitchens. So I'd be curious how he would see the world if he would still be alive. And also, the religion is bad and you can't do anything with it. And now she comes out and says, okay, she's completely changed her mind. She's now a practicing Christian and everything. But the question then is, it's not so much, I would argue, and I do not doubt her faith, don't get me wrong, but she arrived at Christianity from this idea, I need something more than just rationality, than just, you know, the hedonism that Western civilization offers. And is that really faith then? I mean, I consider myself a faithful person, but I've been religious very much, I don't even know why, but very much from the outset. So I did not wake up one day and looked at the world and said, I need something to believe in that has a supernatural quality to it, that has something, you know, as a transcendent quality to it. And then I just happened to pick Christianity. That's still a little bit the, it's a hedonistic approach that is cloaked, if you want, in religion. Again, I'm not attacking her personally, but it's, I think it's not the same kind of faith you just, you know, hold as if it is second nature, because it isn't for them. Right? Again, as I said,
She's approaching it from her head, not from her heart.
Yes, and precisely. But yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. But a true cult, true in the sense of a dedicated culture, is one where so much more comes from the heart than from the head. Or as I'm, you know, as you can tell from my accent as an Austrian/German, it's the kind of Nietzschean approach. It's the true measure of a civilization is its capacity for will. So this was always his argument, that in an argument, it's not necessarily the side who is right that wins, it's the side that wants it the most. And we see this. I mean, this was the interesting part about the whole woke movement. It didn't matter that 90% of the things they were claiming were factually wrong. Their will, like, they wanted it more than the other side. And if one side really wants you to believe there are 100 genders, and the other side that only believes in 2 genders is kind of shrugging the shoulders and says, nah, what do I care? Then you'll end up in a society that openly will claim there are 100 genders. Because at the end of, and this is the one point where Nietzsche was right, at the end of the day, history is made by those who wanted more. But, and just to give you another quick example for you American listeners, this is very often forgotten. If you look at the American Revolution, it is not true that everybody of the 13 colonies wanted to be independent, but those guys who wanted to be really wanted it. Mm. And those who didn't want were kind of middle of the road, that they moved to Canada. So I said, nah. You find it a little bit also in the Bible, in the sense of that being lukewarm, being in the middle, very often doesn't cut it. Again, I don't consider myself a radical, but the idea that in the course of history, the moderate powers win out, that is not true. You can have radical moderates and then they win out. But in general, that the moderate, middle of the road, I don't really care position is going to be victorious, I see no evidence for this in no history book. There's not in no religion. I don't know a single story of significance in the human endeavor that says, you see the kind of don't really care, lukewarm, middle of the road guys won in the end. I have no example for this.
No, cycling back to Lindsay, I know several years ago, and this is pre-COVID, he talked about when wokeism was really at its zenith, and he talked about a God-shaped hole. So you have all of these people in that sort of in that strata looking for something to give them a greater meaning. And this sort of critical social justice fit that bill because they didn't have any form of other spirituality to grasp onto. Whereas I'm also seeing it from a crisis, because I've grown up in a fully atheist family. I'm more agnostic, but we didn't have faith as a pillar growing up. So I'm probably like, would have been a bit like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who I would be looking for something from my head because it was never there in my heart. Individualism has been under attack. What has always set the Western ethos apart was the ability for individuals to stand out and stand up and actually affect change, even if that change was very small in the community that they were in. But individualism has now been attacked and replaced by this group, this collectivism, this you must go with the herd. Do you think that we're now starting to shake free from that? That people are waking up, those cocoons of expectation set down by those in critical social justice. Governments love it when we're all towing the line and doing what we're told. But we're actually now starting to wake up and, you know, reclaiming our no. Do you see that? Are you starting to see hints of that?
I think you're right. I mean, I would say, let me give you a twofold answer. I think one is the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, and for those of you who haven't heard of him, I'm sure that you did. I mean, he's a fantastic. First of all, he's one of the most decent human beings I know, but he's also a fantastic scientist, and he
wrote the Coddling the American Mind, which I've talked about here.
Yeah, the Coddling of the American Mind. Right, he wrote The Anxious Generation, Now About Education. And his breakthrough was The Righteous Mind, where he talks about why people are divided why good people are divided by politics and religion. And the argument that he makes is that, well, as a species, we are both. We can be very selfish, very individualistic, very atomistic, but we can also be incredibly groupish. And the problem with the state or with any form of government is that, as you correctly pointed out, the government would like us to be somewhat groupish, right? Mm-hmm. You want to toe the line, so they want you to believe in the common cause, and you know you wanna identify, you wanna lose yourself in the broader mass. And I think that's also a good thing. This is why I'm personally a fan of nationalism, or as I said, or if you want to call it enlightened nationalism, where you understand, you say, I'm still Ralph, right? I kind of with my as you are Marie with your, you know, with our idiosyncrasies and our uniqueness that I think we definitely have, but I also understand that I'm part of a historical flow, right? So when I read a history book of Austrian or German European history, it speaks to me as part of myself. So I, you know, as you know, there's like Abraham Lincoln, the famous saying, it's like, you know, it's the chords of memory that tie generations together. It's like a river, right? You can never step into the same part of a river twice, but that it's still there. And this is the combination of this individuality, but individuality embedded in a history. So I'm Austrian, I'm European, I'm still an individual, but I'm not, you know, Persian. I'm not Turkish. I'm not Vietnamese. And this is never going to change. And as you correctly pointed out, wokeness in the end was trying to use the concept of individuality to break, if you want, with at least partially, with also these groupish sentiments, because their claim would be you can be whatever you identify as. Now, that this then in itself morphed into a violent, if you want, or a very extreme collectivism, kind of, if you do, this is the big fun of this, right? They say, you can be whatever you want, but if you don't believe that, then you cannot be one of us. It's a very odd thing in a sense. It's on the one hand, it's super individualistic, but if you say, well, so I can do whatever I want, it's kind of, no, not necessarily. It's a very odd philosophy because, and I talked about this with Eric Kaufman just recently, because of course it is not really a philosophy. This is, and I mean, I think this is why I think that James very often gives you too much credit when he tries to, which is interesting intellectually, when he tries to embed it in kind of broader in ideological forces like fascism or Marxism. You know, Yoram Hassoni makes the same argument, he says it's neo-Marxism. Again, Jordan Peterson makes the same argument, it's neo-Marxist, but it's not. It's a very interesting phenomenon because, first of all, it doesn't really have, there is no book, right? You have, with Marx, you have Das Kapital, and with National Socialism, you can at least claim you have, you know, Hitler's Mein Kampf. Like you have, and Mussolini was a prolific writer, whatever you think of the man, but it's this, he was somebody who thought about his ideology. Lenin, the same thing, you know, Mao Zedong, these people did a lot of writing and reading. Again, a lot of it, we might now look back and say, oh boy, these are all crackpot theories, but nobody can claim that they did not make up their mind. Or to use a positive example, the U.S. founding fathers. Right? Mm-hmm. If you look at me, they really made a huge made a huge effort. And you know, if you look at the U.S. Constitution, if you look at the American legal system, so these are you know, very thoughtful designs to create a political community, to create a state, to you know, create something that is based on a supposedly at least intellectual foundation. Wokeness is all about feeling, right? I mean, that's the thing. The whole idea, for example, that, you know, words are violence and safe spaces and all these things, that's based on emotion. I don't necessarily mean this in a good or bad thing, but it's completely different. That there is no, yes, you have you know, people like Ibrahim X. Kendi and Robin the, you have the grifters who kind of latched onto this, but there isn't really a woke Bible where you say, oh, this, how would you build the state on wokeness? So it isn't really a recipe for it. This, as you said, right, you just attach stuff to it. You have a DEI office, you have an officer for grievance, you have this, you know, you have a Native American representative, you have all these things, you have the LGBTQ action group, but it's not really an ideology where you say, now we're going to entirely rebuild this thing as a fascist, as a communist, as a Islamist institution. And one aspect of this, and I say this very carefully because of course I'm a man, so I have to be very, you know, careful what I say, is if you look at who is mostly drawn towards wokeness as an ideology and who's strongly active in it, it's a very feminine movement. And that's good for the women, don't get me wrong here. But that's a key distinction. That's not Marxism and fascism particularly. These were not in any way, shape, or form, what we would call feminist, like not feminist in the sense of feminism, but feminist in the sense of, you know, more emoting than calculating. And I'm dealing a little bit in stereotypes
here, but I do know what you mean, because what critical social justice has gone and done is it's gone and played to the natural base emotions that women generally have, and empathy is at the heart of that. So it's gone and weaponized our empathy against us in order to follow a set of very bad ideas. Because if you are just to dip your toe into a lot of the initial critical social justice theories, like, you know, you're not going to be racist to somebody, you're going to care for this person, you're going to be open and accepting, all of these seem like really good things. I had never quite decided whether or not critical social justice and wokeism is a cult or a terrorist organisation. And just listening to what you've just said, in terms of there is no sort of centralised sort of leadership or anything written down or ideology, you've got the odd grifter. Well, see, that's what you need for a cult. Generally, there is one charismatic leader or charismatic ideology that you follow, whereas a terrorist organisation is often broke down to separate cells and is completely decentralised. And that is very much, I see, what in the woke canon, you've got all these little silos out there. So you've got sort of the extreme fourth wave feminists in one group, and then you've got the gender crew, and then you've got different, and they're all sort of differing, and they'll come together from time to time, but they're very decentralized, and it's a very difficult beast to fight, because they are highly motivated, and when they start getting into your organizational apparatus, like education or local governance or lawmaking, anything like that, they're like a tick. They're very difficult to get out.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, I think actually your analogy with a cult is very useful here. It's very helpful, because the attractiveness of a cult, like, very often is that it attracts people who are somewhat lost. And if we can extrapolate this phenomenon and say, well, if you have, quote unquote, a significant, let me put it this way, if you have a significant part of an entire civilization that feels lost, then they will be attracted to, you know, to cult-like movements. I mean, I think what's very important also to mention here is that this has particularly affected the intellectual or the supposed intellectual class. And that has always been a problem in the West, because, you know, you have all the university professors, the students. So they are above everybody else. So the working classes, you know, the working class actually still has in many areas a strong identity. You know, they have their commute, or they had. We have to talk about this because kind of the negative effects have also trickled down to them. But usually they were football fans, they liked to go to the stadium, they had their neighborhoods. So their life was actually filled with more meaning than the quote-unquote intellectual classes. And the intellectual classes couldn't abide by that, right? It was almost shameful to them that those who are beneath them seem to appear to have a more fulfilled life than they do. So their negativity, I would say, then kind of bled through to the actual working class. I mean, if you take many of the wokest parties, I mean, this is again something that you see now. Who left them? The working class. You can call yourself the Social Democrats or the Labour Party or the Democrats. Like, if you go woke, you lose the working class, because they say, what are you talking about? Right? And it's even funnier if you look at, for example, you mentioned race is such a big issue for them. The working class is like the most multiracial class there is. If you go into a US store, if you look at who is driving the trucks, like, they have no choice. They're not isolated. The average English literature faculty is more white than the average, you know, long-haul truck crew. But it's those guys who only work with other white people in the faculty lounge who then tell the guy who works with people of another race, color, and religion all the time that they're actually the racists. And you could do this for a while, but I think we reached breaking point, because there was, as so often, nobody who pointed this out. And in his own, you know, absurd way, Donald Trump was the person to point this out. I mean, even everybody who knows Donald Trump, just to stick with the man for a second, knew that this man is not a racist. He's blusterous, and he's, you know, he's vulgar. Mm. He's not a racist. Everybody knows that. Because the problem with this is the same thing, as you mentioned it before. It's you need something to fill your life with meaning. You need something to struggle against, to fight against. There is a fantastic part in one of those books that everybody talks about, but barely anybody has read. Francis Fukuyama's End of History is still a fantastic book that I recommend everybody to read. And I just read it recently, so I can give you even the page numbers. It's on page 330. It's just a coincidence, because I looked it up a couple of days ago, where he says, well, The end of history seems for him a realistic option, but he says the biggest problem could be that if we get close to this utopian world where all the big questions have been answered, that people will get so bored that they actually start to struggle against a just order just for the sake of struggle. And this is what you see happening, I think, in many parts now. Now, the idea that European, Western, American, Australian, New Zealand societies are like the worst and most racist societies on the planet is completely absurd. We are, by any measure available, the most welcoming, like the most open, the probably the best societies you can live in, which is the reason why everybody wants to come. I mean, the other thing, right? If we would be as racist as the intellectuals and the media tell us, nobody would come. They would all say, whoa, well, I'd rather stay where I am. But if you want to experience real racism, go to North Africa, go to Egypt, go to Pakistan. I mean, that's if being black in America has its issues, don't get me wrong. But try being black in Libya. I mean, we talk about actual slavery there. I mean, the world is in many areas still a horrible, horrible place to live. And the best ones, without you know, and a second thought, is the West. And again, is it perfect? Of course not. But that's always the problem. If you then say, well, you're not perfect, so therefore you're deeply, deeply flawed. Well, but nobody is perfect. But if you compare it to any other place on this planet, it's a great place to live. It's a great way. It's a great place to be. And it's something that very often migrants, by the way, know. This is why they come, which is, I think, what people who work their way up know. I would say, you know, think about Elon Musk, but it's the people in the universities, in academia, in education that have an issue with it. But the problem is, and here I come to I just built up to the climax of my argument, but it's those people we hand our children to. So you and I know what's going on. Yeah, you have 8 teenage boys in your house. So
yeah.
Because this is, you know, if you talk to them, I have a very strong sense that you will instill them with very good values. But what are their teachers telling them? What will they learn at the university? So if they don't go to school and they are being taught that New Zealand is a horrible place and Australia is a horrible place, and then they go on to university and they the West is a horrible place. Some of them will shrug it off, but some people will get affected by it. And we come back to the migration question. Imagine you come to another country, euphoric of being part of the new society, and then you go to school and everybody tells you, we are a horrible society. We are so sorry for being such a horrible society. I think it was... they had this thing in New York or somewhere where the white children were told to tell the black children or the children of color why they have privilege that the others have not. I mean, this is child abuse, because nobody is more forgiving or nobody has a better time in overlooking differences than children. So you take small children and divide them into racial groups in the name of anti-racism. I mean, this is the absurdity that we live in. And I think that was a positive effect, if I might say so, of the whole COVID policy, is that with, you know, Zoom school and everything, that parents all of a sudden saw what their children are being taught in school. Or when you think of Bill Ackman in the United States. And as a final point on this, I mean, we see that the entire tech industry, the Jeff Bezoses, the Elon Musks, the Peter Thiels, and many, I think, who would not like to be named but who did, they're all shifting to the right, because they all realize that, you know, this is just no longer working. It was a luxury we had, you know, it was fun in the 90s. Actually, it wasn't even around in the 90s. This was really a phenomenon of the first 20 years of the 21st century. I mean, if you ever, I'm sure you do, I do it on occasion, if you watch a TV show like Friends, I mean, half of the jokes you could no longer, they're still funny, but you would say, oh boy, we would make that joke like, you don't know what would happen to you. And most people want to go, you still want to be able to tell jokes. And this is if somebody would ask me, how would you measure whether a society moves in the right or wrong direction? My criteria would be, how does it deal with humor? Like, and what you see, I mean, Germany is a good example, but also the UK. If the government starts to persecute people for telling jokes, then you're in trouble. And yes, I know people say, are you saying that the UK is like Nazi Germany? No, I'm not saying the UK is like Nazi Germany, but I think if we set the bar that high and say that every tyranny is acceptable as long as it's not Nazi Germany, there's a long way from freedom to Nazi Germany. And honestly, I think that even if we are halfway there, it's a place I don't want to be.
It's funny with the boys, is that I've seen, like we talked about the femininity, the over-feminization before with this wokeness, you know, they play on our natural emotions. And one of the things that they've done and the ideology has done is that it has de-emasculated our young men. Big time. And so I've spent a lot of time, because I've got two sons very close together, but all their boys are here. The listeners know this. I talk about it ad nauseum. Anyhow, we've worked really, really, really hard to instill positive, rugged masculinity in these young men, that they feel strong in their own skins and that their masculinity is something to be cherished, not something that is toxic. Whereas you look at a lot of the young men that I think are in this millennial generation who are the most depressed ever, and I think Jonathan did touch on it in his book, and I know Abigail Schreier is talking about it in her book,
Therapy,
they're like the cuttlefish generation, you know, that Jordan has talked about. These poor guys have literally been stripped of their vigor. And I look at now someone like Donald Trump, and I think that's why someone like Donald Trump has become quietly so attractive to these men, because they're now actually able to express themselves at a ballot box or in a way with a strong leader. Now, I'm going to pivot slightly because you are in Washington, D.C., and I want to get your thoughts on this before you go. And speaking of those who've got great depression, is everyone running for the antidepressants in Washington right now? How's the mood post the election? And what was the scuttlebutt on Hunter Biden's pardon? Because that came like a bolt out of the blue.
Well, I think the mood is generally good. I think the last time I saw the latest polls on Donald Trump's transition team as he's putting it together, he has a 61% approval rating, which is quite fascinating in a country where usually everything is 50-50. There is a sense that he really is trying to upend the status quo. And I hope, you know, he will not... We don't want to switch one cult for the next cult, so he will not save the world or something. But if he makes a couple of adjustments that put the trajectory in a way that it's going up instead of down, I'll be happy. You see that there is not a lot of, as it was 8 years ago, there is no resistance movement or anything. It seems that everybody has A, made peace with it, and B, silently hopes that he's going to be successful. That's at least my sense, and of course wishful thinking as well. The Hunter Biden part, it's just amusing. I have to admit, it's... I think it's also a little bit it's Joe Biden's last middle finger to his own party, that he has never forgiven Nancy Pelosi and the rest of them for ousting him from running for the presidency. I'm pretty sure that he still believes that if he would have run, he would have beaten Donald Trump. I think if he would have run, it probably would have been an even more landslidey victory for Donald Trump, because he is senile. He's non-compos mentis at the moment, and it's very hard to deny this. Of course, the bigger issue here is, if you look at the kind of pardon that he issued for Hunter Biden, this is obviously not just to cover Hunter Biden, this is also to cover himself. And it shows something that behind closed doors everybody knew, he's not the only one, let's be honest about this, but that in fact Joe Biden has been one of the most corrupt career politicians in Washington since he first entered Congress, I think in 1979, or was it 1879, who knows. And so this is something that was known, that his entire family got rich off him. His son Hunter Biden openly said it when he was asked once, when people said, why are you on the board of an energy company in Ukraine, what do you know about Ukraine, what do you know about energy? And he openly said, well, nothing, or next to nothing, but my last name is Biden, and that's enough. Yeah, and it was enough, right? I mean, this is not a secret. And the famous saying that he has to hold the money for quote-unquote the big guy, where I think it's pretty clear now who the big guy is. I'm just speculating here, right? But it seems quite obvious that it's the person that still claims or thinks, or what others think, is still the president of the United States at the moment. And we talked about James Lindsay today. It proves the iron law of woke projection, which is that everything the left accuses the right is something that they do themselves. Do I believe that the American people are particularly upset about it? I don't think so. Both of us are too young to remember this, but I think it's a little bit like with Richard Nixon. You know, when Gerald Ford gave more or less a blanket immunity or a blanket pardon to Richard Nixon just to make this whole thing go away. It's the same thing here. But it did, of course, reinforce the sentiment that if you are close to power, if you are, you know, close to the political machinations, then different rules apply. I mean, it's absurd. I mean, Washington, D.C. is the richest state in the United States by far, more than Massachusetts, more than New York. And what exactly are they doing here? It's closeness to government. It's closeness to government, and there's something wrong. So it's not closeness to the productive forces of this country. It's closeness to those who regulate. It's closeness to those who quote unquote govern. And this is something that I hope that particularly Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy will be successful, because we have become an over-bureaucratized, over-administrated, over-regulated society. This goes back to the point you do made before about individuality, right? It's this idea that whatever you do, you feel you need a government permit. I mean, somebody, I think it's in Austria and Germany, somebody once did a study, and they said technically every second Austrian or German is in permanent breach of a law. It's just there are so many of them that you know, nobody keeps track. But this is the insidious thing, because you create a situation where hypothetically the government has something on you any day, you know, any day of the week, any week of the month, any month of the year. They just can then choose or not choose to prosecute you. So they for example, you make the tax code so complicated that everybody makes a mistake. You know, you book a flight wrong, or you fly somewhere and you also visit a relative, and then you put it in as a tax expense. So if they want to find something on Marie Bushke, they find something on you. And again, you're not a democracy then, right? This is not government by the people, for the people, and of the people. If the government can basically constantly hold a metaphorical gun to your head and say, if we want to do something about you, we can. It's the famous saying of Stalin's head of the Secret Service, right? You know, show me the man, I show you the crime. And this is the world we live in. And then people wonder why nobody wants to go into politics. And whatever you think about the legal problems of Donald Trump and if they're justified or not, you must be crazy. People, they only see the outcome. Do you know how much energy, how much time, how much money this costs you? Like, your lawyers have to meet, because you cannot just ignore it. You cannot just shirk it off. So any reasonable person says, I'm not going to go close to this. You have to be a sociopath or a quasi-psychopath to do this. So very often I find when they say, oh, Donald Trump is a narcissist. Of course he is. If you wouldn't be a narcissist, you wouldn't do that. You have to be partially insane to do what he's doing. But I still hope that he's going to do the right thing, and that, you know, we are in the foothills of a new golden age for the US, which I hope that it will translate into a new golden age for Western civilization as a whole.
On that note, I think that's a perfect place to leave it. Thank you very much, Rolf Scholhammer, head of the Centre for the Pride History at the MCC in Budapest. It's been an utter joy. We're going to have to do this again next year, Rolf, I think.
Anytime.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Hey, back to you, Paul, here with Reality Check Radio, and I hope everyone's having a fantastic day today. Thank you, Rolf.
Thank you, Marie.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to, or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.